The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Chris Nynum is a founder member of the Stop the War Coalition. He was one of the organizers of the February 15th, 2003 demonstration in London, and he was central to the international coordination that led to the protests going global. His book, How the Establishment Lost Control, is due out on August 25th, and in this episode we discuss the success of Jeremy Corbyn. Some other Zero Books titles to check out include Angela Nagel's book, Kill All Normies, Joanna Dimmer's Anatomy of a Thought Fiction, That Existential Leap, A Crime Story by Dolan Cummings, and Edmund Berger's Uncertain Futures. It's Thursday, August 3rd, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, consider joining the Zero Books Club. Zero Books Club members receive access to a Saturday podcast entitled Inside Zero Books, which sometimes features the second half of conversations with Zero Squared guests, and sometimes features conversations with Zero Books readers about the state of the left. Zero Books Club members are also invited to participate in YouTube workshops with Zero Books authors and others. The music you're listening to right now is the opening theme from the motion picture Cutter's Way. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Chris Nynum and I discuss How the Establishment Lost Control. Christopher Nynum is a founder member and national officer of the Stop the War Coalition in the UK. He was one of the main organizers of the 15th of February 2003 anti-war protest against the invasion of Iraq. His book, How the Establishment Lost Control, is due out from Zero Books, hopefully sooner rather than later. Christopher Nynum, welcome to the Zero Books podcast. So let me just ask, what moved you to write How the Establishment Lost Control, and how has your book changed as events have unfolded?
Well, I started thinking about it a few years ago, really. I mean, there were a series of events in Britain that I thought were kind of signs of a real cracking of establishment consensus and or consent for the sort of regime in Britain, which I suppose the near-miss Scottish independence vote in 2014 was one of them. And then the obviously the Brexit vote, you know, was a big shock clearly to the British establishment. But I mean, in a way, we myself and other sort of colleagues have been thinking about this now for a number of years, and there's been all sorts of signs, straws in the wind, really, about the kind of growing sense of democratic deficit, sense of alienation from mainstream politics, but not just politics, also other key institutions in British society. And, you know, we'd been looking at the polling ever since really the economic crisis in, you know, 2008. And it showed sort of collapsing levels of confidence in major British, central British institutions. And, you know, I thought this is very significant. And what we felt, and what I felt more and more as the independence vote happened, the Brexit vote happened, you felt as if, to quite a shocking degree, the commentariat were completely surprised, and even sections of the left weren't getting it. And in fact, we're seeing breakdown in sort of support for the key institutions of the British state in terms of, you know, almost a sense of pessimism and bewilderment, which I took to be completely wrong. And I felt, you know, that something else was going on, that actually there was quite a radicalization going on. So that was the starting point.
The book's title is How the Establishment Lost Control. What did they lose control of exactly?
They lost control of hearts and minds to the extent that they ever had it. And secondly, I think particularly in the last couple of years, they've begun to lose control over the population's kind of actual behavior and their actual political choices they make. Mm-hmm. You know, in parallel to that, I think they've lost control in the sense that they don't really have a strategy for British capitalism anymore. I mean, even in their own terms, you know, neoliberalism is a failure. I mean, in a certain sense, it was always about doing something other than what they said it was about. It was always really mainly, in my opinion, about a fairly crude redistribution of wealth and resources from the general population to the rich. You know, that worked up to a point, but it was covered by this idea that, you know, it was going to see a return to profitability and a return to greater levels of investment, and that didn't happen. And that was one of the ways that its credibility started to decline. Once people start to question it in a very serious way, and once people start to act against it, to vote against it, to take to the streets against it, then it stops working as a strategy for redistribution of the wealth to the rich. And so, you know, I think now they face this situation where they don't really have a way forward, and they are internally massively divided.
Chris, you know, my cat is unfortunately scratching at my door, driving me crazy while I'm listening to you. Can you hold for just one moment while
of course.
I get,
okay. Of course.
All right, come in. Come on in.
Now that I've let her in, she's going to climb on everything in my office and knock things down. But we'll see how it goes from here. When we talk about neoliberalism, what I generally think of, I mean, there's lots of different definitions of the term, but what I generally think of is it was an economic, well, it was a political project to manage the economy after the boom of world that came after World War II started to end, and there was a crisis of profitability. Mm. So that neoliberalism was about trying to prop up the productive sector and keep things running along and avoiding economic crisis. Do you think that's true?
Yeah, I think that's broadly true. But I think there's a kind of ambiguity at its heart, and that rests in the question of to what extent it was really about restoring levels of profitability, and to what extent it was rather an attempt to to what extent it was about restoring profitability in terms of you know, reducing wages, reducing the wage bill in sort of manufacturing and production in such a way that the return on investment would increase, or whether there was always a strong sense in it that it was a kind of more predatory operation, a cruder operation, which was trying to wrest back whole sections of the economy that previously had been, you know, run by the state, and simply transfer those areas of the economy back into private hands and to make a kind of, you know, a kind of land grab of them. And I think that element of it came as it became clear that profitability wasn't being restored by attacks on trade unions and a simple attacks on wage rates. I think the more predatory, the cruder element of it came to the fore. And so I think it's been a kind of I think as it's developed, it's transformed itself, really. And I think it has become cruder and cruder, and less about any kind of serious attempt to restore profitability to, you know, to industry. Certainly in Britain, if you think about Thatcherism, I mean, you know, Thatcher destroyed the manufacturing base in Britain. I mean, that was what happened. Mm-hmm. You know, in a very, very in a very, very crude and sort of destructive way. So I think it's always had a very, very kind of, right at its heart, it's had a very, very kind of crude class robbery element to it.
Jeremy Corbyn said something recently in the last year or so. He said that studies have shown that redistribution of wealth downward is actually the better path towards profitability. When you make sure that people have a living wage and that you make sure that the unions are strong and that working class people have power, that is actually good for the entire economy and including capitalist profitability.
I think in the short term, a program of, you know, state-run investment can create, you know, can begin to sort of to take the country out of what is essentially a kind of long-term depression that the economy is going through at the moment. I don't think that that long-term it can solve the fundamental issues here, because I mean, what we're looking at, I mean, Britain is the kind of one of the worst cases in a really a global kind of crisis of profitability that goes back. I mean, it's, you know, obviously it has regional variations and it has variations over time, but essentially since the slowdown in the 1970s, there hasn't been a return to the kind of growth levels or the kind of levels of profitability that we saw in the 50s and 60s. So there's clearly a kind of more long-term fundamental underlying problem with return on investment, with levels of investment, of which obviously financialization is a product. So, I mean, the way I would see the kind of Corbyn project that you talk about is that, yeah, I think that over the short term, state-run investment can provide some sort of boost to the economy. But the most important thing about it is that it reasserts the idea that there can be some kind of, or should be some kind of, democratic control over the economy. And that is a very important kind of political fact. And I see that being its fundamental significance. And, you know, then you would hope that in that process, people would start to deepen that sense of democracy, to deepen some kind of idea of, you know, we need to actually think about planning the economy. So I see it as part of a process, really, that needs to be picked up from below and driven much, much further. It will come up against all sorts of obstacles as well. And I think that's one of the things I talk about in the book, that we have to be very clear that, you know, if Jeremy Corbyn, and it looks more and more likely, if Jeremy Corbyn does at some stage become prime minister, that will be the beginning of the story, far from being the end of it. That will be the moment where, in all sorts of different ways, the sections of the state, the establishment that have been trying to sabotage him on the sly or through, you know, kind of demonization in the media and so forth, will move much more decisively to try and demoralize his regime, to try and sabotage it, really. So I think that, you know, we have to be ready. That kind of Keynesian moment can only really take us forward if it's accompanied by a very, very serious increase in the levels of popular mobilization and popular participation in the project.
So what do you think the meaning of Jeremy Corbyn's success is in light of the Brexit vote? Are those two things in opposition as much as they seem? Are they two different sectors of the population competing for control there? Or is Brexit somehow connected to Corbyn in a more positive way?
I think it is. I think it's very much connected. I mean, I think that it's a complicated, the whole Brexit phenomenon was a complicated and contradictory one. But I think the whole of the commentariat and big sections of the left called it wrong, really, in the sense that they misunderstood the meaning of the vote. I mean, you know, all the kind of studies, and I go into them in the book, I mean, they all show that clearly worries and anxiety about immigration played an important part in the Leave vote, but they didn't, they weren't the main factor. Most of the polling and the studies and the interviews suggest that there was a, the kind of deeper concern was one about control, was one about a sense of society, you know, becoming kind of completely hostile to large sections of the population, and a feeling that, you know, people's concerns and needs and requirements were just being completely ignored, and that one element of this, and after all, no one asked for the Brexit vote, really. I mean, it was kind of a referendum that was conducted for purely internal party political Tory party reasons, but once it was on the table, people had this suspicion that, you know, the European Union was undemocratic, remote, unconcerned about people's ordinary everyday lives, and that was the main reason, in a complicated mix of things, that was the main reason why people voted for it. So in that sense, yeah, I think it was part of the same phenomenon. Now, you know, that could have gone in a number of different ways, that the kind of slightly kind of you know, instinctive kind of statement of Brexit could have ended up going in a number of different ways politically. But because the Corbyn project was there, and because, in my opinion, Corbyn took a sensible attitude to the result, he was able to turn that concern about control and about democracy and about the economy being completely alien and hostile to the lives of ordinary people, he was able to turn that in a sort of progressive direction by relating to it very, very clearly and arguing that, you know, there needed to be a complete change of direction over neoliberalism. And so when you got to the actual general election, you know, for all that Theresa May tried to make it about Brexit, it really wasn't about Brexit. I mean, Brexit wasn't, very often wasn't even in the top five things that people were talking about.
Right.
You know, so I think, yes, I think the two things are connected, are linked in a complex way.
Since the election of Trump in the United States, we've seen on the, maybe say, far left or the socialist left, a dramatic, if not immense, uptick in interest. For instance, the DSA in the United States has grown in membership very, very quickly. And the Bernie Sanders campaign hasn't really ended, which I would have expected. I think if Clinton had won, it would have been forgotten. It does seem like in some ways, the fact that the neoliberal establishment in the United States failed has opened up a space for the left. But I'm concerned because, on the other hand, it seems like in 2011, during the Occupy movement and the Arab Spring, there was a deeper sense that change needed to happen. In other words, there was a sense that change needed to happen, and more people thought it needed to happen on a deep level. Whereas now, it seems like the contest is between different forms of managing the same crisis-prone, unequal, exploitive system of capitalism. It seemed like capitalism itself was more squarely in people's sights 6 years ago. Do you think I'm right about that, or what do you think?
Well, I mean, partly you're talking about the States, and you know, you obviously know more about that than me. But I mean, you know, I think there's a number of different things that you're raising there, very interesting things. I would say, certainly in Britain, I would say that that in a sense the opposite is true, really. I mean, I think after the economic crisis, I mean, there was, you know, there was discussion. I mean, Occupy wasn't as big here as it was in the United States. There was discussion about the system and, you know, about capitalism. But and it was, you know, relatively widespread. I mean, you know, it got a bit into the media and stuff. But it was nevertheless, you know, essentially quite a narrow thing involving a few hundred thousand activists and maybe going a bit beyond that. What's happened now is that, you know, the concerns, those kind of concerns in a slightly different register are now being voiced by literally millions of people. I mean, you know, 13 million people voted for Corbyn in the election, and because of the attacks on him from the riot and because of the way that he was demonised as being a raving lefty, those people knew who they were voting for. They knew they were voting for a left-wing leader. Now, that's not to say some people weren't just voting Labour despite Jeremy, but, you know, you've got to assume that at least half or more were basically backing him, and really probably more. Now, that's an extraordinary thing because, okay, it's true that, you know, this is a left social democratic programme that he's putting forward. But it seems to me that there's one aspect of the situation which is important to register, which is that, you know, what was back in 1945 or even 1960, what you could have seen as a sort of fairly mainstream social democratic set of demands, which, you know, while not consensual in the establishment, nevertheless was sort of grudgingly accepted up to a point. Now, because neoliberalism is so embedded and because, you know, I don't see any move in any serious way towards any kind of alternative amongst the elites, the basic social democratic demands that Corbyn's put forward set him and us on a collision course with the establishment. People may not necessarily have totally realised that, although I actually think, you know, there are quite a lot of people who do. But it seems to me that it's a very explosive situation now, even though, as you suggest, you know, the programme may not be historically that radical. The context is everything here. And whereas in the 1960s, an expanding capitalism, a higher level of profitability meant that the bosses had a little bit, were prepared to give a little bit in order to keep the thing rolling. They were prepared to give something on wages, give something on the welfare state, give something on. They're not prepared to do that anymore. So it seems to me that, you know, a similar set of a return to that politics now, obviously updated, but nevertheless in some ways a return to that politics now, has much more explosive implications than it did back in the 50s or the 60s.
Okay, I agree with you that on that last point completely. My only fear is that the reason why it's more explosive now and the reason why the elites are less willing to in general make concessions in that direction now is because the economy is much weaker now. Not just because of a neoliberal project to undermine productivity, but because of the way capitalism seems to go in cycles, and there's a tendency for the rate of profit to decline. So I worry that if the working classes aim at these, I'm going to just put it in an American term, sorry, but a return to the New Deal or social democratic program, that when it fails, there will be an even larger right-wing reactionary moment than there has been so far. That we, unless the working classes, unless people are, understand the limits of, say, Corbynism to begin with. In other words, unless people know they're going into making these demands as radical or revolutionary reformist demands, we may not end up on the other side of this in a way that we like.
You know, very, very important point. And, you know, I mean, in any kind of social transformation, you know, I think attempted social transformation, the level of kind of understanding and consciousness amongst the widest layer of activists and participants is, you know, is absolutely critical. And, you know, I think what you say is right. Having said that, there's another point that I try to make in the book, which I think is, you know, I think the left does need to really think about, which is that throughout the period that I discuss, which is essentially the period from sort of Thatcher taking power, I think there's been a tendency for the left actually to underestimate the level of consciousness that can be develop and does develop amongst working people, and to sort of make a crude analysis between combativity and understanding. Now, a parallel, to see the two things as the same. Now, I mean, the working class movement got the shit kicked out of it in the 1980s. The decline set in before that, but the response of, you know, lots of people on the left, including the leadership of the Labour Party, was to basically say, okay, people have given up on socialism. They don't really, you know, everyone's bought into the market, bought into neoliberalism. They think liberation equals shopping. We've got to go along with this. And I think that was, you know, funnily enough, that move by the left or by the leadership of the Labour Party, which was reflected even in the so-called Marxist left in lots of different ways and still reverberates throughout academia in sort of Foucault and Chomsky and all sorts of different forms, seems to me has been a very, very dangerous or debilitating tendency. Because, you know, obviously it's true that that, you know, working class people don't automatically understand, or you know, the class as a whole, or millions of people don't have an automatic insight into what's going on. But I think class consciousness is much more sophisticated and developed at all times, really, than most on the left think. And I think people can learn very, very, very quickly. And so, I mean, I've been struck by, one of the things that we on the radical left in Britain are saying now is, you know, vote Corbyn, get rid of May, but stay in the streets. We've got to keep fighting. Now, that is not, I tell you, that is not a kind of minority sentiment. I mean, that's something that I think millions of people agree with now. You know, and the fact is, we've got to learn something from, we've got to sort of take a warning from the fact that the left didn't believe Corbyn would become get anywhere near being leader of the Labour Party. They didn't think he'd win the second time round, and they thought he'd bomb in the election. So, you know.
Well, I mean, who do you mean when you say the left? I mean, because I knew a lot of people who have been very supportive of Corbyn all along and who did think that he had much more. I mean, my joke was that whenever he would win, someone would come along and say that it proved that he would never win. You know, it was crazy. He just kept building. So isn't the left a little bit more split on Corbyn than that?
Well, I mean, it's, yeah, obviously there are, but I mean, no one, I mean, going back to the beginning, I mean, no one thought he had any chance of winning in 2015 when he first stood, including him. And that was partly because, you know, people were out of touch with, I mean, clearly that shows that the left was out of touch with the kind of popular mood. And then when he started to gain momentum, or when he won the election within the Labour Party, oh yeah, that is just people on the left, you know, that is a kind of regroupment of the left, was the case that was put. And then Brexit, you know, that was seen. I mean, there was lots of people saying that, you know, after the Brexit vote, that what we're seeing is a resurgence of the right, that we're seeing a kind of move towards a kind of right-wing nationalism, even the development of fascist tendencies in British society. I mean, the extent to which, obviously there are lots of exceptions to this, the extent to which the vast majority of the liberal left commentary and sections of the actual left called this wrong, you know, every time, is a matter of concern. So therefore, sorry, it's a long way of saying that I think we need to, you know, we need to sort of get back to the idea, which in a way has been a bit buried, that you know, socialist ideas basically come out of experience. I mean, they come out of an interrelation between experience and, you know, conscious theory and the development of it. But that essentially, you know, it is from the experience of, for the vast majority of working people under capitalism, is an absolute pig. And, you know, in a way, why is anyone surprised that this is kicking off? I mean, the last 35 years have been murder for the, though not just for traditionally regarded working class people, but for the vast majority of society. They've seen their pay go down, they've seen their conditions plummet, they've seen, you know, so why is anyone surprised? I mean, in a way, what's surprising to me is that it took this long to happen. And I think one of the reasons it took this long to happen is precisely because the left kind of, you know, collapsed and gave into neoliberalism. I mean, not the whole of the left, but I mean, obviously, mainly the Labour Party. And so, you know, the whole Blairite experience kind of prolonged the death agony of neoliberalism, or prolonged the kind of, or gave it a kind of, you know, artificial boost, really, that it should never have had.
See, I just worry that maybe we're underestimating the truth of a claim like the Brexit vote represented a victory for the mentality of, say, UKIP. That because I don't know if there's a really clear disconnection between the kinds of willingness to see things fall apart in the name of change and relief. That seems to be easily picked up and used as a weapon for the right as well. And that, you know, that there's sort of a contest between the right and the left, and that the fascist right always sort of copies and borrows from the left. So I'm just unclear, both now and then back when that Brexit vote happened, to what extent to take that seriously as the fascist threat, say, seriously.
I mean, obviously, it's a complex situation. And as you say, I mean, when you get a kind of social and political crisis on this scale, it is going to lead to polarization. I mean, there's no question about that. You're seeing the collapse of the centre, which happened in a weird way in Britain, because actually what happened is the two main parties of British capitalism got, you know, had a huge share of the vote. But nevertheless, this, you know, in a strange way, this does represent, you know, the meltdown for the sort of consensual politics that have dominated in the establishment for the last few decades. And that is going to lead to a polarisation. But, you know, the crucial question is, given that, is what, on what terms is that polarisation happening? And I think there's this kind of, you know, partly because of decades of defeat, there is a kind of gut instinct on the left to think that, you know, oh my God, when there's a social crisis, it's the right that will always benefit. Now, I think what happens in a social crisis, they're obviously complicated and as I say, context is everything. But what you see is a battle between the left and the right for hegemony, for leadership, for its ability to express the anger and the bitterness that people feel. And it seems to me that undeniable that in Britain at the moment, the left is way winning. You know, I mean, and that's important, because the problem is that, you know, unless we understand that, and unless we then start to try and work out how to take maximum advantage of that situation, then, you know, we'll lose the initiative, and we mustn't lose the initiative, because it's precisely the moment when we lose the initiative on providing a way forward and providing answers and providing an analysis that we open the door for the right. And I feel like an obsession at the moment, or too much. I mean, clearly we need to be. I mean, there's loads of people around where I live being attacked in the street with acid. You know, loads of Muslims. I mean, there's horrific things happening. There is an increase in racist violence. This is all true. And the left has to take this seriously. We have to counter these things. But we have to have a very serious, you know, a joined up strategy that prioritizes the main issue, that can deal with the different elements of the situation in a way that is proportionate. And it seems to me that the key question even when it comes to how do we sideline and defeat the right, the key question is how do we make the most of the Corbyn breakthrough? And that's what we have to, you know, put at the heart of our strategy without ignoring the other very, very serious issues.
It's customary on these occasions to congratulate the returning Prime Minister, and I absolutely do so. And I congratulate her on returning, and I'm sure she will agree with me that democracy is a wondrous thing and can throw up some very unexpected results. And I'm sure we all look forward to welcoming the Queen's speech just as soon as the coalition of chaos has been negotiated. And, Mr. Speaker, I just let the House know and the rest of the nation know that if that's not possible, the Labour Party stands ready to offer strong and stable leadership in the national interest.
Smith walks way down the street with his holding way down low. Ain't no sound but the sound of defeat.
The electorate's ready to vote. Are you ready?
Hey,
are you ready for this? Are you
hanging on the edge of your seat?
Into the boxes, the ballot slip
to the sound of the beat.
Yeah.
Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust.
And another one gone.
And another
one gone.
Another one bites the dust.
Hey. I'm gonna get you to
another one bites the dust.
Another key issue that sort of spins off the whole question of where the left is going is the relationship between mass participation, the mass movements, and what's happening in Parliament. And I do think this is a critical question, because obviously and I think in a way this is what you had anxieties about in what you said about the situation in the States, but that, you know, there is the danger that people do feel, okay, we've got Jeremy in leadership of the Labour Party, it's probably going to be an election soon, he's going to get elected, he'll put through a progressive programme, and that's kind of, you know, that will solve the problems. And I think, you know, it's very, very important that no one is under that misapprehension. And I mean, one of the interesting, very, very interesting sort of elements of all of this is that Jeremy's whole project itself is a product of mass movements. I mean, the key central reason, I believe, why he ended up being the person who expressed the kind of, you know, the zeitgeist, to express the sense of complete outrage and anger with the neoliberal project, was because he's been on, you know, he's been in the streets for 20 years. He's been on, or 30 years. He's been on every picket line. He's been on the demonstrations. He's been part of the Palestine solidarity movement, the anti-war movement. And I think it can't be an accident that it was this man who got propelled to the leadership. And I think that shows that people do have a certain understanding of the importance of, you know, a participatory mass struggle-based, movement-based political response to the situation. The important thing is that we cling on to that and we say to people, I mean, right now, actually, the general election, although it was very good for the left, it didn't resolve the situation. You know, we have a terrible Tory government which is clinging on to power, and the only way we're going to get rid of it is by taking to the streets again. That's the truth. Mm-hmm. and deepening the movements, and, you know, so that's one aspect of it. But the second aspect of it is that, you know, if we're planning for a Corbyn government, I mean, we have to say loud and clear that for him, in the face of the kind of opposition that he is going to run into from various elements of the state, from the right wing of the Labour Party, from the media, you know, he's not going to be able to push through his kind of radical programme unless he's backed by a really major social movement or series of social movements that are actually coordinating. And I do think this is, you know, I understand people rushing to join Labour and to get involved with Momentum, and I applaud that. And, you know, clearly the left in Labour needs to dominate and they need to sideline the right. But even when it comes to the question of, you know, who dominates in labour. It seems to me that the street mobilisations, the strength of the trade unions, the popular participation in an active way in mass movements is going to be critical. And that's a message I think we've got to continue to put out there, because this is a very serious situation. We've kind of stumbled almost semi-accidentally into an absolutely enormous historic level political, social, economic crisis in Britain. And there's no way this is going to be resolved in Parliament. It just isn't. And therefore, you know, the development of a very vibrant extra-parliamentary left that is capable of drawing in millions of people into activity is going to be absolutely crucial.